detail, and so if members are tardy, that's because there are probably some of them that are still in caucus getting their briefing. In addition, two of the members of this panel, Representative Bates and Representative Westland, who are part of the audit group, are working with a legislative council trying to come up with the enabling legislation to recommend to this group some of the changes on the Oregon Health Plan. And so if you, I need to share that with you, because if you see the members that are not there, it isn't because they're not busy in other places of this building taking care of legislative work. And I know sometimes people see us on the TV and they'll say, oh, well, you have all, not all of your members are present. And it is because they're off other places in the building still working on legislative matters, so I just need to put that on the record. With that, we're going to begin with
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taze from Seniors and People with Disabilities. We're starting today on page 61, and we're planning to finish Medicaid and long-term care services, move into developmental disabilities, and assuming we get through that, we'll then start on rates. So Mary Lee Fay is going to continue her presentation from yesterday.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm the administrator for the Office of Home and Community Supports, the Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. And before moving into developmental disabilities, as James said, I wanted to wrap up with a few other items and respond to questions that were raised yesterday on the service levels and some of the issues related to people who have been transitioned from services. I believe Senator Gordley was asking if we have ability to identify and find out what has happened to individuals either in February or starting in this month who have lost services as part of this current biennium. We have been informed by a couple of our partners, that the county partners, the area agencies on aging, that they have indeed been doing some tracking and will put together some information from us. We also know that some of the providers and provider associations have been working on identifying what's happened to those individuals. So by the last day of our testimony, we hope to be able to bring back to you information about where today the people who have stopped receiving the long-term care services are and what the impact has been on that. I also wanted to mention the one other item that we didn't get to was just on that transition planning. We had talked about what options were available and the case managers work on meeting with each person and really going through a very challenging strategy of what services could be available for someone after they get out of Medicaid long-term care. We were able to, with our federal partners, also have a very small, what was called a community transition process. What that meant is that the federal government would match our general fund dollars for some one-time only transition activities. So if someone needed to have modification to a home because there's no longer someone there who can stand by and support them, we could cover those costs. For someone who had been not living in their own home, receiving services elsewhere, we could help with some of the cost of moving into a new place. Primarily, it was really going to be used for training people who are friends or neighbors, people who are not typically had been paid as ongoing staff. So they're very small supports, but they might indeed make a difference for a person. And again, it was by no means did we envision that it was replacing the full Medicare type of services, but it is a program that we were allowed to do. And we'll give, again, a report on that at the very end of our testimony. With that, I'd like to move on to talking about people with developmental disabilities. And as yesterday, what I'd like to do is go through the definition on who's eligible for services, what do the services involve, and how are the services delivered, and talk about some of the issues of areas that had been in jeopardy as far as services being cut out of our budget. Starting on page 62, we talk about the eligibility for people with developmental disabilities. Like in the seniors and people with physical disabilities, The Medicaid financial eligibility is also 300% of supplemental security income. But the other eligibility is very clinical, unlike the seniors and people with physical disabilities, where we looked at an impairment level and a care level matched with services. Here we're looking at a clinical level of mental retardation or developmental disabilities. And on page 63 and 64, it really gives an explanation of that, of the disability. We look at both an IQ standard, or we look at another impact that actually has someone functioning similar to. And on page 64, it will say that the disability cannot be as primarily related to things like mental or emotional disorder.
A question, just to interrupt
Madam.
For a minute. And it's something that you can provide later. But it would be helpful, James, if we had an organizational chart to show, because all of my members aren't familiar with who determines how the eligibility process works, you know, looking at who's involved in this whole system. I think that would be very helpful, where the AAAs are, you know, how the AAAs interrelate with the state agency, so that there's a much broader, clearer understanding of the operation. That would be very, I think, helpful for the members of this panel.
All right, Chair, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Moving on to page 65, where we talk about service options. And very, again, this is going to be very similar to the seniors and people with physical disabilities, in that it starts with the idea for Medicaid, that a person who is eligible for Medicaid and meets these requirements is eligible for the institutional setting. In for people with developmental disabilities, that's called an intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded, or ICFMR. That's the equivalent of kind of what the nursing home facilities would have, the nursing facilities would have been in institutional settings.
I have a question on ADHD. Is that the attention deficit?
Yes, it is. It's attention deficit. And, Madam Chair, those are the areas that say the developmental disability cannot be related because of these items, such as mental, emotional disorder, substance abuse, or a learning disability such as attention deficit. Outside of the institutional settings, like in our other programs, individuals are offered choice by Medicaid law. And that choice is delivered in the community, and there are two options, either in a licensed community living setting where they are receiving 24-hour level of support from an agency or a foster home provider, or in their own homes. And we'll talk about how that has really turned into programs that have been identified under the Staley settlement. A little bit of history on the intensive care facility for the mentally retarded. Again, that is the place where they have the basic, it's a 24-hour full range of service, including what's called active treatment. That's a federal requirement, and it requires that each person has a plan that goes beyond health and safety and talks about how they actively are integrating in their environment. And on page 67, just a little bit of history in that, in the early 1990s, Oregon had both private and public intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, but the challenge to meeting those federal requirements really resulted in a number of those private agencies changing from those settings to small group homes throughout the state. And we closed, that left two state institutions, Fairview Training Center and Eastern Oregon Training Center. In 2000, we closed Fairview. So the one setting in Oregon that is an ICFMR, an intensive care facility for the mentally retarded, is an Eastern Oregon Training Center. That's located in Pendleton. There currently are 45 people who live there, and they also have the capacity to serve five people at any time who we consider are in crisis. And those are typically short-term stays, an average of maybe up to 6 months, and it's because there was no local option to manage that crisis at that moment.
Just a comment that the closure of Fairview and the work that was done in that closure also produced an agreement that you will hear sometimes that relates to the state-operated group homes. I need to say that because that comes up from time to time. And there was, in order for us to comply with the feds and others, an agreement that was reached between the state. As that there would be for those individuals who were more severe, that there would be the homes that the state operated in order to accommodate that population.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 24-hour comprehensive services, or services in these licensed community settings, are really done in around the state in a number of small homes, and they all, like our senior and people with physical disabilities side, all must provide basic room and board, and on top of that, additional support such as medication management, assistance with daily living, planned activities, general supervision, and employment or other day services. In our settings, sometimes that employment agency may be the same provider as those providing residential services, and in some communities, they're different agencies, a variety of nonprofit organizations. As Madam Chair mentioned, the majority of our programs are run by private nonprofit. There is a small number of homes, 33 homes, that are run directly by the state and support some people with some very significant support issues. And an important feature to mention is anyone who is eligible for these homes are eligible for the institutional care. On page 72, we really just talk about the number of programs that are out there around the state. There are 571 agencies, homes that are licensed, not agencies, homes that are licensed. There are 487 foster care, licensed foster care programs. 160 of the, on top of that are for children. And our employment or day service agencies, there are 147 of them. So you can see there is just a very large system throughout the state in every community that is supporting people with developmental disabilities.
How many, I think the number of these that are state operated?
There are 33 homes that are state operated.
Of this whole total, is that what you asked, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay, of all four categories only, 33 are state-operated.
Right. So of the 571 homes, there are 33 of those that are state-operated. And they serve 141 people.
Okay.
On page 73, talking about in-home services, there is aside from having people have to leave family homes, Oregon wanted to be able to also provide some supports to people who can stay within their family and really do a public policy where you look at the informal supports that a family member might be able to provide and match that with the public support, still creating full 24-hour services, still making sure that individuals are staying in their community and are healthy and safe, but a partnership in a different way, really looking at a lot more of the informal resources. And there are three significant programs that we have done with this population or with this type of a model. The first is a children's intensive in-home. The second is children's support services, family support, and the last is adult support services that was created out of the Staley settlement.
In comparison with other states, how do we stack up when we talk about this particular program?
Madam Chair, I believe that when you look at the adult services in other states, I think Oregon has taken a significant step forward in looking at large numbers of people that will have access to that service. Some of it is because the settlement agreement really had us direct services that way. I would say when we get into looking at children, Oregon is not as high. There are many states who have a lot more, many more programs for families with children in their homes. Many of the states have been able to ignore parental income and use federal dollars where they have been able to offer services on a broader range to a number of families. In Oregon, we have a similar program, but it's very limited. It's in the intensive in-home program, and there are about 170 children total in those programs, so it's a very small number. Our family support program has not been able to use the federal dollars in the same way.
Why is that?
Madam Chair, it's because once you make available a Medicaid program, everyone who's eligible for that program needs to have access to the same system. So it's been a barrier for us to look at the resources that we have in Oregon to support families and be able to do that and not make it a more entitled service.
Could you provide us with a comparison of how we rank with the other states as it relates to both the adult support service and children's support service, and also provide me with some information on the issue of the family support, particularly the income.
And the Medicaid program.
And the Medicaid program.
Yes, I will do that.
Madam Chair, some of the and we'll get you all that information. Some of the high points, though, Oregon in terms of spending on developmental disabilities, quite apart from the senior and physical disability population, we rank about 26th, I think, nationwide in the per capita spending on the DD population. Similar again to the senior side, though, we have one of the lowest institutional rates in the country after the closure of Fairview. We're just kind of off the chart in not using large congregate care institutional spending, but it really was a very closed system until the Staley Agreement on the adult side opened it up. And again, as Mary Lee said, we've not kept pace with kids. So,
on page 75 through 78, there's an explanation of the children's intensive in-home services, and I think highlighting for you there really that what Oregon has done is looked at a very small number of children whose needs are quite extraordinary, and where parental income is not considered a factor, often these children's costs far exceed what anyone's salaries and income could help support. So, but in doing so, we've also have a very tight criteria. So we really are limiting, for example, in the medically fragile program to those children who are technologically dependent, meaning they use ventilators, they may have tracheostomy and require a high involvement of support and supervision because of their health needs are so acute. We also have a similar program for families whose children have some extraordinarily behavior supports. And again, the criteria is very limited in that we're talking about children who have really some of the most significant behaviors and whose levels of support are so involved. Their children often don't sleep through the night, and so families really are needing some assistance and support. But with that assistance and support, are very happy to be the partners at the table and have their children stay at home.
I so. See we have 80 children who are served under the medically fragile, and that we have a waiver?
Yes, Madam Chair, the medically fragile children is a demonstration waiver. It allows us, it's a model waiver. It's a very small number of children, and it allows us to ignore parental income. So that's one of the areas where we have been able to enroll children and get Medicaid dollars without having the families themselves be eligible for Medicaid.
Was it 99 when we funded that?
96,
97.
Madam Chair, 97 or 99, one of those we...
On page 79 is an explanation of the family support program. And some of the differences here is that this is a program where local county developmental disability offices.
Mary Lee, what's the cost on the medically fragile children?
Madam Chair, I don't have it in my material here, but I can get back
to
you.
Could you give me the cost for the medically fragile as well as the medically involved?
Yes.
And for also, you might as well give me all those categories that you highlighted.
I'll get back to you on that. On the family support, at this point, this is where counties, the individuals who are eligible, of course, children who are living at home with their families, children meaning under age 18 with a developmental disability. The local counties can, they take the allocation and they do some local prioritization and working with families on small amounts of resources that, again, will help a family. And as you can see on page 80, the dollars that are used are really directed by these principles, that it's really necessary to maintain the child in the family home. The services are cost-effective. They don't replace normal parental responsibilities. They don't replace public school responsibilities. And they don't replace service and goods that may be obtained through public and private insurance. So it's a very effective program, really looking specifically at what the additional issues that a family faces by having a child with a developmental disability. On page 81, it lists the types of services, and I would say respite care is a very high service that's used in this particular program. The last area of in-home, I just want to spend a little more time on, and that's the support services for adults, and talk about the Staley Settlement Agreement. Starting on page 82, it really referenced what the lawsuit was about, and it was really the result of growing wait lists and access to Medicaid services, or the not having access to Medicaid services. And the plaintiffs basically alleged that the state failed to provide services in the most integrated setting for adults with mental retardation or developmental disabilities who are eligible for placement in the intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded. So the number of wait lists, people often were on a wait list for decades and were not able to get services. That resulted in a lawsuit, and on page 83, the result of that lawsuit was the settlement, what we refer to as the Staley Settlement. And it really was a compromise that allowed for expansion of in-home services, which is certainly a less expensive way of responding to many of the plaintiff's issues, and a very small number of access to comprehensive care. It basically covered any adult with a developmental disability, someone over age 18, not receiving comprehensive services. So we can't use these monies and supplement a foster home or a group home. They're a very separate population. And the other important factor here was that no person would be receiving services that totaled more than $20,000 per year, and the average is actually $800 per month. And that became the principles for setting up this Staley Settlement Agreement. In the implementation phase, which is on page 84, some of the things that we did differently was we really felt that both the rigors and of an entitled service, both the ability to maintain the cost effectiveness and the management of rolling out an entitled service, meant that rather than going county by county on delivering services, we actually looked more on a regional approach. We did a request for proposals and formed what was called service brokerages. And there are 10 service brokerages that have responded. On page 85, it talks about one of those is a county. Multnomah County operates a brokerage. Seven of them are organizations who were formed specifically to do the support services for adults. Their boards of directors are many stakeholders in this field. And two of the agencies also deliver other types of care, such as residential or employment. So we actually got quite a mixture of organizational entities and really spread out across the state to really economize.
Senator Shields.
It's probably premature to ask this, but have you worked with these enough to three different categories enough to have any sense of who's doing it better, who's doing it most efficiently, anything like that?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, we've been operating for a year, and I don't think we have information that would say, does one type of organization do better or worse? One of the things we have found is, by no matter what organization it is, it really has some firewalls that has a director who's full-time on this, and they meet monthly with our staff. We have had probably the most interactive involvement with agencies than we have typically done. So we have not yet been able to discover, are there problems from one type of organization to another?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, if I could just add to that, one of the advantages in when we negotiated this whole package with the federal government, because it's part of a whole home and community-based waiver as well, but in these service brokerages, we got federal agreement, which was sort of the first in the country, to include all the costs as a program cost. I mean, there's a very small part for the administration of these brokerages, but everything else in terms of negotiating the plan with the family or the individual, actually setting up a payment system to purchase those services. There's a fiscal fiscal intermediary function that's covered as part of the service rate itself. So we were able to kind of move all the money out to the brokerages instead of the state having to do multiple contracts and run checks and payments. And so it's been a reasonably efficient way of almost like a health plan, a capitated rate for a whole group of individuals, and I think that helped us achieve some significant economies of scale that otherwise we wouldn't have been able to do.
On page 86 and 87, like family support, the types of services that are provided, really there's some guiding principles about the effectiveness, the cost effectiveness, that it's really what we're paying for is related to the disability, and that we're not replacing what can already come to the table. And then on 87, just kind of the types of assistance that are very common in these support services, general assistance with activities of daily living, to develop and maintain employment. A number of the individuals in these programs are using the service to help get employment, respite care of another very large service. I don't have the numbers, but the many people are living at home with families rather than on their own. So respite has been a very important factor for this particular program.
Mr. Thames, did we cut, have you had a chance to look at the new co-chair's budget?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Have you had a chance to look at the new co-chair's budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, just very briefly, we really don't know the detail at this point.
Because I want to know, and maybe you can give us this later, some perspective on the effects of respite care not being a part of what you do, since some people have no break whatsoever if they're caregiver for a family member or something of that nature. And I was just trying to find out, if you look at past history at all, before we start giving respite care, and it seems now we're going back in that direction, and what do you think the effects of that would be?
Okay.
Madam Chair, the other thing we will be able to produce, because I think you asked about, or one of the members of the committee asked about some implications and stories. We have, because we also run a lifespan respite, have some information that we'll provide committee members at the end of our testimony. We'll be gathering that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be crucial.
On page 88, finalized, let me just summarize with where we are with all of these services. The numbers of people who are in what's comprehensive services, that was the group homes, the foster homes, employment-related services, versus the support services, the family support, in-home and intensive. The numbers of people in Staley today are 3,122 in some format. In the family support, there are 1,250 children who have been impacted by family support. This is all part of the Staley budget. So these are the individuals that if Staley had not been or was not to be a part of an 03-05 budget, these would be individuals that would be losing support who are currently there today.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
John, will we be seeing the cost breakdowns for these categories?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, Chair Winters just asked for that. I think that was some of what you were going to provide us, costs on a monthly or yearly basis for each of these categories.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I understand.
Last item under Staley was at the very beginning of our presentation, there was a question about how changes that have been made just in 0103, and I believe Mr. Britton has a form that really looks at where we started as far as the budget went at the beginning of the biennium, some of the cuts that were made or reductions that were part of the e-board sessions. Those reductions didn't result in reductions to client services. We had delayed starts, and we did not fund an 11th brokerage. There was some variation there, so we were able to come up with savings. But on the third graph, that would have been what we would have done without with the reduction. And then, of course, the there was an additional 7.4 that was redirected back into our budget. So the last column of a total of $62 million is what was left this biennium to support those somewhere 4,500 people.
Senator Shield.
I keep looking at this, and there's this little voice in me that says, at what point in the graph would you end up back in court?
Well, had we stayed at graph number three, we would have been back in court. Certainly at that point, because that would have said we would have spent, that's to date, we would have spent that amount, and that eliminated services for people in the brokerage services. So at that point, we would have been back in. As part of the plaintiff negotiations, and we still have not finalized that draft, but certainly the plaintiffs recognize that freezing enrollments, which is what we've done to date, we've stopped any new admissions into the brokerages, we've frozen enrollments in family support, basically looked at any areas that we could continue serving the people we had made a current commitment to, but not adding to. That threshold kept, I believe, the plaintiffs willing to negotiate with the state and looking at longer-term impacts.
So, follow-up?
Follow-up.
So you're suggesting then that the $9 million difference, which is still $20 million below the core Staley budget, is enough to forestall a lawsuit? Or is that just you're betting on that, or what?
It was enough for 0103 to allow what it does. It allows the brokerages to continue, which is a very critical factor for the plaintiffs. It allowed these in-home supports to continue for people who had already been enrolled and receiving those services. And so it was enough of a placeholder to really get us into 0305 and a certainly future biennium, because the Staley settlement agreement is a longer term picture. So I think the plaintiffs certainly understood the reasonableness of freezing things as long as we weren't cutting existing people. That kept us at the table and kept us really working together rather than getting into more litigious and potentially much deeper costs.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, the other factor here is as we rolled this program out in the first year and a half, we've had significantly lower per case costs than we originally budgeted in the original Staley agreement. We negotiated and allowed an average of up to $800 per family or individual on a monthly basis. And above that, because the settlement agreement said you could go all the way up to $20,000 a year as a cap, but we set some very stringent criteria above that $800, so very few people sort of get in that part of it. But even having negotiated that threshold, many families who came into the program for the very first time have requested even much less than they would have been allowed under the settlement agreement. We think over time, assuming Staley has continued, that will increase up to the cap. But The entire dollar amount there wasn't from cutting or freezing services, but was actually people in service just spending less than we originally anticipated when we settled the suit.
Madam Chairman, follow up to that?
Senator Shields.
That would indicate to me that either you're getting... Let me reverse the question. Is it a pretty typical random sample that have entered at the beginning, or is it people that maybe had less disabilities that entered at the beginning? Is there something demographically different about them than what you anticipated, that the costs would have been less than you anticipated?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, and Mary Lee can probably answer this better than me, but we prioritized who got into the settlement agreement in different waves. So we had a rollout that included different waves. Because the settlement agreement wasn't just new money. It was taking old money, because we separated 24-hour care from non-24-hour care. The non-24-hour care was the part that we negotiated the settlement as the entitlement, knowing that if you entitle people on the 24-hour side, the cost would simply be in the stratosphere. So when we did that, we also took people in our old system that may have gotten a little bit of family support or employment-only services or things like that, and have moved them into the brokerages. Then you have another wave, which is people that were getting absolutely nothing at all that were coming in for the very first time. And we have another wave that's coming, which are people that receive only employment services that will... So it's been a mixing and matching of new and old resources to put this sort of entitlement package together. So you have people with very different experiences in either having a little bit of service or none at all, that are entering.
Senator Shields.
I guess my point in driving at this question is, you know, number one, I am concerned about the agreement and that it hold together and that you don't end up back in court. But if in the early phases of this it's coming in under budget, and if the population served isn't representative of the population that you would expect to come in over the next whatever number of years, the legislature here could say, hey, you know, this really isn't going to be as expensive as we thought, and you know what that would do. You know, and so we would be sitting here trying to pare this down, when in reality, in the future, unless this is an absolutely random sample of what you'd expect for years out, to tell us that it's costing less than you anticipated, we'd say automatically, we'd say, well, keep it less, keep it at that level. And so I'm just concerned when I hear that.
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, again, it's not a random sample. I mean, this is a rollout. We really don't have the length of time or the experience to know. And the other thing is if, in fact, we tried to lower or cap the per-person cost at a much lower level, we would really have to renegotiate the settlement agreement itself to do that. And I'm not, since the plaintiffs already considered what they did a compromise in essentially agreeing not to demand 24-hour services, which they have done in many states and litigated that.
Definitely.
I'm not sure that, I think as we project this thing into the out years, we're assuming it's going to come up to that cap.
I'd like to say, for the record, you know, that the plaintiff's willingness to go back in and to sit down and meet and work with the state agency and others, recognizing the budget crisis that we're in, is really a plus. And so I just need to say that on record. I know when we were going through the e-board, some of the discussions and some of the issues in November, and asking them then, were they willing to negotiate? And there's been this willingness to partner with us, you know, in recognition of the budget crisis and the budget situation that we're in. And I, you know, if all of our groups come to the table with the same willingness, it certainly would make things a little easier, I know for me. So I just want to, on the record, thank them for their willingness to sit down and to work with us on this issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the last program that I'm going to talk about takes us back to services to seniors and the Open Project Independence, or OPI. It begins on page 89. just a slight bit of history here, that this is a program that began in the mid-70s, 1975, and the purpose at that time was to provide community-based long-term care services for older adults not receiving Medicaid. Throughout our history, we've now been able to use Medicaid dollars for that, but this has still been a very critical program for prevention of long-term care Medicaid services. The seniors, the difference here is that this is a program where the seniors in this particular program have the same types of service level needs as was described yesterday. The difference is that they do not meet the financial eligibility for Medicaid, so they have incomes that are slightly higher that put them at the Medicaid level of that 300%, but the types of support needs they have are quite similar. And the program has been intended to maintain individuals in their own homes, keep them healthy for as long as they can, and not put them into positions of spending down resources, their own resources, at a very rapid rate that then makes them eligible for the Medicaid long-term program. So to be eligible, their individuals are 60 years age or older, or someone with an Alzheimer's or dementia-related disease. They can't be currently receiving cash assistance with the exception of food stamps or assistance with Medicare premiums, and that they require the long-term care services as defined by some of the service priority level rules, that they're living in their own homes. And the other feature of this is that individuals are required to pay on a sliding scale basis their support services and contribute to their care.
Would you provide us with the number of individuals that have been participants of OPI over to the last biennium and by age? And since it is a range between 100% and 200% of federal poverty, give us those figures, and then also what is the sliding fee scale?
Madam Chair, if you go to page 94, there's some data here that I think might help with that. The number of people that we've served in OPI in this year is right around 3,800. That's different. That's down from last biennium, where there were about 6,000 people served, and of course we've had a reduction in allocations. So you'll see that map.
Question.
Just a second. It would be helpful for me if you took some comparison information of the 9901 and the 0103 and actually have those numbers as you do that, and also a client distribution where they are around the state. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're down 3,800 from 6,000, you said, of the previous biennium. What's happened to that? What's happened to those people who are no longer receiving those services?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm sorry, I don't know that I can get that for you as far as we can ask our agencies if they indeed have tracked to see if individuals have come in to the Medicaid care program because they've no longer received services. Not information that has come necessarily to us, but I will get back and find out if we have some of that information.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
I'm tracking Representative Smith's comment. Maybe agencies can't tell you, but at least anecdotally, I can tell you as a pastor that followed some of these people in the community through churches that I used to serve. You can't take 2,800 people who you helped stay at home, mm-hmm. withdraw their services without seeing them deteriorate, and end up in more expensive settings where the state then pays in one way or another. And so what I'm asking, it may not be scientific, Madam Chair, but I'd like to ask if there's any way we can come up with some kind of a guesstimate as to the cost of cutting those services to those 2,800 people. I mean, if we're trying to save money, then I think we really owe it to ourselves to try to find out what the cost really was of cutting those people. Have they showed up at other places in the budget and cost us more, where if we had managed somehow, some way to keep that $2,800 on, it might have cost us less. There must be some way to figure that out.
Couple things I would like to piggyback in on that, and I don't know, and I think it's important to know what kind of data do you request from the AAAs that would allow us to do the kind of tracking for the questions that we're asking.
Yeah.
And that would be very, very helpful if we knew. And then and those that are non-AAAs, I mean, what does the agency ask as a part of the data collection? And so if we could have, you know, that, and then it becomes what happens when the person is no longer in the system.
Madam Chair, we can bring that back to you. I think the other pieces of data on here is that certainly if you look at either 30% of the clients are assessed at service level 3 or 43% at service level 10, it will indicate that people truly are here because they have significant need. And many of them are between the ages of 80 and 89, and many of them are women. And living alone. So I think it's been a very critical program that has supported some very vulnerable Oregonians.
And the other piece, since I'm asking for information, is the sliding fee scale. You know, what are those levels based on what level of income? And also, where do those dollars go?
And Madam Chair, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead and respond. No.
There is an updated report that you'll be getting from this with our budget notes that really talks about where we are to date with Oregon Project Independence, including the collection of client fees. A little less than half of the people are contributing because they're at the level where their income really doesn't allow for it. Mm-hmm. Many of those that are contributing at small amounts because they're just slightly above that level. So we've got some individuals, large numbers, who pay somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 a month.
So when will we get that report?
It's part of our...
Madam Chair, I think we're bringing all of the reports from... We have, I think, nearly 10 budget notes, and I think on the sixth day we were planning to bring all of those reports.
So I can hold my questions until you...
And I think you'll see a lot of the data on that because that was one of the key parts of the budget note.
Senator Shields, you want to hold yours until we get the report?
Yeah, I do want to say that as we ask questions, I don't want to see us just asking the AAAs because they're already underfunded and understaffed and everything else, and maybe they don't have a way to follow clients after they come off. But somewhere in our overall integrated services system, we ought to be able to try and at least extrapolate what's happening to these people, even if it's on a calendar where we made so many cuts and then over at Jim's end we saw more people go into nursing homes or whatever. There ought to be some way we could do some intelligent extrapolation.
Senator Shields, I selected that because last session, if you know, the budget notes that were placed in this agency's budget had to do with their contracts with the providers of those groups that said we were going to become consistent in how we collected our data. And also looking at performance, and it's consistent with what we've asked the agency in our last budget cycle. And you can't get a total picture unless you also include those provider groups that are out there that are partnering with the agency. So it's not just the agency, but it's the groups that they're working
right
with.
And Madam Chair, as you'll see in the report, the amount of reporting and the monthly reporting that the area agencies on aging are sending in is really been a very good turnaround. We get monthly reports from them. The last page on page 96, you will look at, we do look at collected fees. You're also going to see a dramatic difference between the fiscal year 2001-2002, where there were $438,000 collected in fees, to, we're obviously not through a full calendar year, but compared to 174 now. And a number of that is because the people who are staying on and receiving services are individuals who are less able to contribute on the sliding scale fee, and that the services that they're requesting are more in line with not submitting payments. So you'll see that in the report. The other thing you'll see that isn't in here is a direction from this committee, from members, particular members on this committee, to look at options for matching with Medicaid. And it's something that we've been asked to do a number of times. We've been looking at it from both how do other states try and do this. And the report on that will say the barriers are still very strong. If Medicaid can be in the home and community-based waiver, for example, the criteria is such that that's what our home and community program does, and these people don't need it because of the financial eligibility. The options for doing demonstration waivers, which the federal government does allow, but one of the things that they have you have to demonstrate is that you're not going to spend more federal dollars after the program started than before the program started. It's called budget neutrality. And it would be very challenging in this to go from a total general fund program and not demonstrate if we began using federal dollars that we wouldn't be using more federal dollars. The group, however, did look and say there are areas of the program where we could really do better at collecting federal match, and a lot of that came around the activities of case management. Medicaid does allow us to bill on information and outreach, and when we're talking with individuals and determining their assessment and identifying whether they can indeed or should be eligible for Medicaid program, those are Medicaid reimbursable costs. Now, that's a very small amount. We probably project maybe up to 10% of that we could extend, but I think the group was very intent on making sure that if we can collect federal match for some of that, that we create the environment to do that.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. To address the question that Senator Shields was raising with respect to the contrast in cost, is there any place you can direct us to look at the cost per client for levels 1 through 10? Because 73% of the clients in OPI, by your data, would qualify in those levels, but they're in home. And if you, and if it, it's a very quick, easy way to a contract, because you get 70, the highest percentage of your population would qualify in the levels 1 through 10. If we just knew what that was for the plant compared to your approximately $10,000 per year in OPI. A very quick contrast.
I'm sure Senator Morris will put some comparisons together.
That's a good one. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that concludes day two, and I think we're done with and ready to move into rates. Unless you have any other questions on.
We're still day two. We're just on long-term provider rates.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to, let's clarify that. We're still in the day two
packet. Sorry, I apologize.
On page 97.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julia Huddleston, and I'm with the Department of Human Service, Office of Rate Setting, and the Finance and Policy Analysis Cluster. And it's out of that office that long-term care provider rates are set. And what we're talking about today in terms of reductions are proposed reductions in the governor's balanced budget for rates paid to long-term care facilities that care for seniors and care for people with physical disabilities. Long-term care facilities in this state, by and large, are for-profit, privately owned small businesses. There are a few corporations, local corporations, that own multiple nursing facilities or multiple residential care facilities, but by and large, as Senator Winter said yesterday, this is a cottage industry that's grown up here in Oregon around the waiver. Medicaid revenue makes up the largest part of the revenue stream. In some cases, as in nursing facilities and adult foster homes, it can be as much as 2/3 or 70% to 80% of the revenue stream. In some cases, in assisted living facilities and in residential care, it can be as little as 5 or 10% of the revenue stream or not be a part of the revenue stream at all. In addition to Medicaid and non-government private pay funding, Medicare pays for nursing facility days for limited purposes. They'll pay for a post-acute hospital stay. They'll pay for skilled rehabilitation up to their limits. But Medicaid doesn't pay for long-term care. So as soon as a person becomes a custodial resident, a long-term resident of a nursing facility, Medicaid is the sole governmental payer. If a person with low income lives in an assisted living facility, lives in their own home, lives in a residential care facility or an adult foster home, Medicaid is the payer. Medicare doesn't pay at all. Long-term care, if you look at page 97, pays different rates based on client needs and different rates in different living settings. In all cases, the rate's based on the client needs, and it's also based on the setting where the client lives. Now, clients can look, for example, a level 9 client, as you heard about yesterday, which is somebody who needs help with eating and some help with using the bathroom. That person could live in an adult foster home, an assisted living facility, a residential care facility. In a few cases, they might even live in a nursing facility. They have basically the same care needs. Their payments are based on their care needs, but also on the setting in which they live. Rates are set centrally within the DHS office itself. So statewide, for the same person who looks the same in an adult foster home, we pay all adult foster homes the same money. There are some limited exceptions to the rate schedule as it's published, but those exceptions are also reviewed at a central office level, and there's central office oversight on what's paid outside of the rate schedule. The rate's not tied to the service priority level. As Mr. Taves mentioned yesterday, the service priority level is a way to get in the door, or historically has been a way to get in the door. Once the person comes in the door, again, based on their care needs and based on where they're going to receive the care, they fall into one of the rates in the published schedule. Community-based care providers, so adult foster homes, assisted living facilities, and residential care facilities, do not have to accept Medicaid clients. They don't have to accept Medicaid contracts. If they do accept a Medicaid contract, they have to allow people living in the facility who spend down to Medicaid to stay in the facility when they're Medicaid eligible, but they never have to take another new Medicaid client. Nursing facilities are different. Nursing facilities, if they have Medicaid, have to allow new Medicaid clients to walk through the door. So there are some differences in the way the different providers are regulated and what they have to accept and what they don't. Now, if you'll turn to page 98, this is just a summary of the balancing act that Mr. Taves talked about yesterday. Our original House Bill 5100 reductions did not contain provider cuts nearly as deep as we'll talk about today. In the original House Bill 5100, there were two provider cuts. The nursing facility inflationary increase that was given on July 1st, 2002 was taken back. That was about $1 million general fund item. And there was a cut of assisted living facility rates down to an $1,125 per month level. When we found out that we couldn't make the client cuts we had originally anticipated, that they simply wouldn't fly, we made much deeper rate cuts. In some cases, these rate cuts are at the levels as deep as they are to balance to the reduction necessary as a result of House Bill 5100 and the December revenue shortfall. Senate Bill 5548 restored the rate reductions proposed in 5100 through June 30th, 2003. The governor's balanced budget assumes that the money is not there for 0305 and that the rate reductions would take effect. On page 99, that we've made rate reductions in four specific areas. Nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, adult foster homes, and residential care facilities. All these caseload numbers that you're going to see here are snapshots. And they're snapshots of what the department's payment records for these facilities for Medicaid clients looked like on March the 31st, how many clients we thought we'd paid for that month. And in most cases, they're self-reported information from the facilities as to what the rest of their occupancy was. So we had staff call up assisted living facilities and say, tell me, how full are you? So that's where a lot of this information is coming from. We do those sorts of calling out and trying to get a feel for capacity and occupancy about once a quarter. So this is the March 31st data. You'll notice on some of these numbers, this is very definitely seasonal data in this population. Nursing facility counts are always higher in the winter. People get sick in the winter, and if you're old and infirm, you may well be more tend to be ill in the winter than you do in the summer. We have statewide 150 nursing facilities. 138 of those accept Medicaid clients. There's different availability of nursing facility care in different parts of the state, as you'd imagine. For example, here in the Salem metropolitan area, Marion and Polk counties, there's 13 nursing facilities. If you go out to Morrow County, there's one nursing facility. There's four counties that have no nursing facility care available. Those are Morrow, Gilliam, Sherman, Wheeler, and Harney. There was a nursing facility in Harney till about the year 2000, and it closed. There's 13,038 beds in the 150 facilities. Those facilities run statewide at about 72% occupancy, and that's based on data gathered by the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research annually.
Question.
Representative Smith.
To me, that seems like a low occupancy rate.
Chair Winters.
We have a shortage of nursing homes, but yet the ones that we have aren't even being used three quarters. What's the deal with that?
Chair Winters, Representative Smith, that is low occupancy. One of the reasons that's low occupancy is because people who might otherwise be in nursing facilities receive less restrictive, less costly care in the community in this state. We have scattered shortages of nursing facilities. We don't have shortages of nursing facilities in the metropolitan area. For example, here in Salem, there's not a shortage of nursing facility beds.
So you're telling me those four counties that no longer have nursing facilities in Morrow, Sherman, or Gilliam, or whatever, they don't want to be shipped to Portland, is what you're telling me?
Senator Winters, Representative Smith, yes, I am.
Well, okay. If we have a 72% occupancy rate, and now, are these privately owned facilities?
Chair Winters, Representative Smith, by and large, yes, they are.
I'll just hold my questions.
Okay. For every 100 beds, we've got statewide 28 are empty. Now, there's regional variations here, too. For example, if you go down to the Medford area, Jackson County has four nursing homes. They have about 500 beds. Based on this March data, they're about 96% full. In Josephine County, there are four nursing facilities. They have about 500 beds. They're about 80% full. So there's variations in occupancy in nursing facilities and indeed across long-term care from period to period, from market to market, and from clients aging, clients declining, to new clients coming in and new residents coming in. Of the beds that are full, 65% are used by Medicaid clients. So Medicaid provides two-thirds of the funding statewide for nursing facilities. On page 100.
When you're using the nursing facilities, are you talking about both the assisted living as well as the nursing home, or one or the other, or both categories?
Chair Winters, I'm addressing simply nursing facilities
okay.
here.
Just wanted to clarify that. Senator Shields.
A minute ago you said that of the beds that are full, what percentage?
65%.
65% are Medicaid. Another question?
Follow up.
Has there ever been a nursing home that got creative, that sat, say, at 72% occupancy for a long time and decided, hey, you know, maybe a few of these extra rooms that we've got or these extra beds, the rooms could be converted into kind of an assisted living with less care for those folks and give them the latitude to come and go as they please. We wouldn't pick up as much, but we would quote-unquote, be renting out those rooms on a short-term basis or anything? Anybody doing anything like that?
Senator Winter, Senator Shields, there have been creative projects like that in nursing facilities throughout the state, and we can bring back information on a lot of what's happening.
So are they then not really setting 72%, but the 72% is the part that's nursing? That's
Senator Winter, Senator Shield, that's hard to, these projects in general, what happens is that they de-license those beds as nursing facility beds. So when I say they're 72% full, I'm looking at licensed beds here.
But Senator Shields, I know that in Mount Angel that they're doing that creative kinds of things that you're talking about, and they'll bring us back others that I know across the state are doing the same thing. They're also where you have individuals who are being released from the hospitals who need, you know, some immediate care. They're doing that. So they are looking at ways of maximizing their the occupancy issue.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shields. I mean, Senator Morris.
Thank you. This is a different way of looking at business than I've ever looked at business before. The logic of paying, reimbursing 90% of average cost from 2 years previous, which means factoring in inflation, you're looking at probably another 6 to 7%. And then you factor in the occupancy used by the Medicaid client, they would have to charge their non-Medicaid clients 48% more, and they're receiving 17% less than cost. Why would they be in the business? I mean, something doesn't make sense here. Why, as a matter of public policy, would we discourage facilities from, I mean, your area is more trouble than mine.
That's right.
As a matter of public policy, we're discouraging people from providing this care. The logic of it escapes me.
Are you asking me the question?
You're the most authoritative person I know.
There's a lot of things that we do in this building that has been public policy that those of us in the business community would not do. I've said it before. It seems like public policy asks providers to do certain things, but then they don't want to pay them for what they do. Whether we're talking about the nursing home community or the ALFs, the assisted living facilities, and I cleaned that up, Senator Carter, right away. And the same is true when we look at, for example, the provider rates when we're talking about the Oregon Health Plan and some of those issues. It seems to be that fundamentally undergirding public policy is that somehow there's an expectation that you pay them less without thinking that we're cost shifting, because you're correct that someone else is picking up that cost, and it's the private pay that's picking up the cost in those facilities.
Senator Winters. The current rate setting system for nursing facilities is an administrative rule, and it's the result of a lawsuit settlement from 1997. And before we went to the system we're in now, every facility had its own unique group of rates, which did not fully cover their cost. And we went in after the fact, and we settled with them. And if we owed them money, we paid it. And if they owed us money, we demanded it back. There was a lawsuit in 1993 when, in the face of another budget reduction, the department tried to reduce rates that would be paid to nursing facility providers. And in the settlement of that lawsuit, one of the points that was agreed to was to move to the system under which we set rates today. And we moved in a budget-neutral way. So there was no new money put into the system at the time. And since the previous system hadn't fully covered cost, this system didn't fully cover cost either. What this system does is this system looks at every facility across the state and develops statewide rates. And most facilities receive two rates. There's a basic rate of care, and that's paid for Medicaid clients, about 95% of them. It's paid for care of clients in nursing facilities. It's currently about $111 a day. There's also for people who have complex medical needs, and basically what we mean there is it requires skilled nursing beyond what you'd normally anticipate from a nursing facility. And that rate is 140% of the basic rate, or roughly $156 a day. There are a small group of kids, mainly at Providence Child Center and in a couple of other small facilities around the state, who are receiving pediatric nursing facility care. They receive their own unique rate of about $250 a day, but it's set in the same way as these rates are set. The cost period that we look at to set rates is, you're absolutely right, it's the information from 2 years ago. So we're now in a rate-setting period, and we're looking at nursing facility cost reports from July 1st, 2001 through June 30th, 2002.
If you look at your 101, that's the, some of the, what she's discussing, 101.
We look at those costs, we audit those costs to make sure they're what are called Medicaid allowable costs, again defined in the administrative rule. And under the agreement we reached as part of the negotiations that came from this lawsuit settlement, we peg that basic rate at 90% of the weighted average daily allowable Medicaid cost. Again, the rhyme and reason there is that this was the system that we had designed in conjunction with the nursing facility industry at the time, and that was the budget neutral breakpoint. That is the reasoning.
There's also, there is an advisory council as well.
There is, thank you, Senator Winters. There's the Medicaid Long-Term Care Quality and Reimbursement Advisory Council, which was created as a result of this lawsuit settlement. And there are 12 folks who any reimbursement change, and certainly nursing facility reimbursement changes that the department proposes that have an impact of more than $100,000, so any change, goes to the council. The council issues its advisory opinion to the department. The department is then required to come back to either the full assembly or the emergency board with the council's opinion. And then the assembly or the emergency board has to approve the rate change before the department can implement it.
Question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I want to go back to the basic rate just so I thoroughly understand this. Taking what Senator Morris raised, by doing 90% of the average, that means you're going to have folks who are high and folks who are low. And by paying only 90% of that average, aren't we actually encouraging folks to lower the quality of care? Because the only way you're going to hit break even is by providing a quality of care that costs below the average.
Senator Winters, Representative Smith, what we're encouraging facilities to do by that 90% level is to operate as efficiently and economically as they can while maintaining the care quality standard that Cindy Hannum will be talking about.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair Winters. Does that formula or that rationale take into consideration that different facilities have different numbers of beds and that a smaller facility doesn't have the number of beds to spread their fixed costs over where a facility of 200 beds does?
Senator Winters, Representative Smith, no, it does not. The previous methodologies took that facility size and occupancy factor into account. This one does not. This one is a very simple methodology.
Just last question, just so I understand this. Thank you. So then your smaller facilities, in order to make up for the loss of the fixed costs, are either going to have to, I guess they're going to have to look at labor as the potential place to find savings. And so then you're going to, and we're only going to pay 90% of that average. I'm not sure how the state's encouraging quality care when we're asking these folks to do it with less than even the average.
Senator Winters, Representative Smith, you raise very valid concerns in this system.
Just wanted to make sure I understood it. Thank you.
On page one, Senator Morris.
Hi. There are just a lot of unanswered issues for me, and I apologize if I'm the only one. The rate that we're projecting forward in the governor's budget is $93.53, basic rate.
Senator Winter, Senator Morris, yes, it is.
When was the last time that we paid that rate?
Senator Winter.
Let me cast it. Thank you. Could we see a history of rate schedule? Because if we're reducing 23%, we will kill this industry.
That's right.
Let me request that you do a rate history for the nursing facilities, for the ALFs, and the assisted living facilities.
Did it again.
Have you used up my $20? assisted living facilities, and also the adult foster homes. And that way we have a history of all three.
Madam Chair, the question would be, what's a reasonable time period in which to compare? You said the rate schedules were not set until 1997?
Senator Winter, Senator Morris, in this methodology, that's correct.
Well, we can go back to the biennium prior to the change in rate in setting the rate schedules and then bring it forward.
Madam Chair, I'd like to see a long enough period to see what the trends are here. Because I have some great
how long of a period
about.
would you like to see, Senator Moore?
Do we have a 10-year?
Well, I don't know if the assisted living facilities, you'd have to go back to the history when they started, when they began. So you have some other pieces, and I don't know what would...
Senator Winter, Senator Morris, we can do a 10-year history.
Yeah, and bring the...
Whatever's reasonable.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
On page 101 is simply a display of what, had we gone through effective July 1st, 2003 and rebased rates or reset the cost in nursing facility, the basic rate that we would have paid would have been $121 a day. And as you can expect, as Representative Smith mentioned, at that rate, we'd have 68 facilities to whom we were paying more than their actual cost per day, and 70 facilities who we were paying less than their actual cost per day. The governor's balanced budget anticipates a rate of $93.52 a day. That's a rate that we last paid effective, the last day we paid that rate was June 30th, 1999. At that rate, 129 of the 138 facilities are receiving less than what it costs them per day to care for a Medicaid resident.
Senator Carter.
Please pardon my ignorance on this one, but say, for instance, if the person that is receiving $750 a month, their own pay, Social Security benefits or disability, whatever, and their home itself costs about $2,300, then do you slide what they can afford to have from that $750 and mix it with the state's portion of that? How does that work?
Senator Winter, Senator Carter, and we can bring you more information, but clients contribute toward the cost of their care if their income exceeds the Social Security income standard. So people do pay in.
Because I know, Madam Chair, when I ran our program at the Urban League, we had people who just could not pay, as a matter of fact. And we were having problems trying to mix our dollars together, Medicaid dollars with OPI dollars, to try to get some kind of balance there, because there were people OPI who were just $1 and $2 above the level and who couldn't even make it because of their rent and all that other kind of stuff. And so it's like it's so mixed, and that's what I like for the committee to have an appreciation for, that there are a lot of these seniors who are not only barely making it, who can not hardly make it, and were it not for these facilities trying to help put those and splice those programs together, we wouldn't be doing as well as we are in the state. And so I just want to take that in consideration, because when I hear the line of questioning, it makes me think that people are more inclined to
continue to cut without some level of consideration for what is already going on. And I think if the state had to assume all of the care for those people who can no longer afford to be on their own, we'd be up the river. And I just think that some kind of consideration should be given for that. I don't want you to bring in a lot of more people because, you know, we're already cutting out enough trees in here. So if you can just tell me what I need to know, that would be all right.
You can tell her, but I do think that this is a very, very important issue that we are very concerned about. Not only to assure that we have the facilities to care for the elderly and at a rate where they're sustained. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. One last observation. As a member of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Economic Development and Transportation, we've had Housing and Community Services and the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department in. I would be very interested in knowing what the reduction from 121 down to 93 is going to have on the facility's ability to cash flow debt service payments on bonds and loans that are financed by the state of Oregon, and what we would anticipate the default rate being on these facilities.
James, bring us the same information that we asked last session when we were having this discussion on the assisted living facilities, because they're the ones that you're talking about, where the state actually holds the mortgage on them. And I think we need to know where they are in the pipeline, what happens under the rates that we're proposing, how many of them would default if we actually implement those rates. Also, where they're located around the state.
Senator Winters, Representative Smith, if I may, I had that conversation with the Housing Department this morning, anticipating the question. I don't have the exact locations. We can certainly bring that. Housing finances 42 assisted living facilities around the state. While some of them are in the metropolitan area in Portland, most of them are in very rural communities. I mean, for example, one comes to mind in Myrtle Point and another one that's in Condon. Housing estimates that the anticipated reduction down to $1,125 per month would cause about 20 of the 42 to become financially non-viable. They're looking at actions they could take to mitigate that, perhaps restructuring loans or any actions like that. Their options get more and more limited. What they can't quantify is also the loss of clients if it occurs in levels 10 and 11, and how many of those people are actually in their assisted living facilities right now.
What I would like, I went through this last session, and I don't want to go through it again this session. I went through this very same questioning last session as to specifically, and I know that they probably know my questions by heart over there, and that is, what is the impact on the community as well as the seniors that are in those facilities? What does that mean, and how many of them will default? I think they have enough financial information and data to tell us of those 42, how many will default. They can even tell us, after we pushed them last session, of about a timeline when they would default. So I think just ask Director Repine to get that information for us. When we know the geography of where those facilities are, I think based on the occupancy of those the individuals who are inside those facilities, we would know what the implications are for those that are there. But I certainly do want that information. I do not want a repeat of last session. We need to know just what this means for the seniors in the state and just what impacts the rate setting will be. Representative Smith.
And I promise not to go down that path because it sounds like you have this under grips. What I'd be interested, though, in knowing is what is the cost to the state of Oregon of having to service the debt?
That's a part of it.
Okay. And the savings we pick up here but lose
here. There's several. What would we do with the facilities if we had to take them back?
Okay. I'll trust you.
You know, it's, we went through this all last session, and so it's a repeat, and so it's still a question, and we just need the same kind of information that we had last time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On pages 102 and 103, there's some information on commercial adult foster homes and residential care facilities. These two sorts of facilities, their clients are paid, Medicaid pays the same amount for client care in both types of facility. The Legislative Assembly in 2001 increased rates paid to for residential care and for adult foster home care. For adult foster homes, we have about 1,920 statewide serving seniors and people with physical disabilities. There's about 6,500 commercial beds available. And about 3,000 of the people who live in these commercial adult foster homes are Medicaid clients. So roughly half of their occupancy is a Medicaid occupancy. These are very small homes. These are five people or less. So any change in a revenue stream to these homes has an immediate impact because there's the smallest base over which to spread your costs. We're currently averaging about $1,113 a month. The governor's budget proposes that we reduce that to $946 a month per client. That's a 15% decrease. Residential care facilities, there's 235 statewide. 80 of these have Alzheimer's units.
Have you done, just a follow-up, have you had conversation with the stakeholders as to what that would mean as far as capacity and the impact on the industry? And I'm looking at the, you know, we talked about the nursing facilities, and now we're into adult foster homes. The same question applies. What is the implications, and what's the impact? Do we lose providers? What happens with these kinds of reductions?
Senator Winters, we have had some discussions with the Adult Care Providers Organization and with different provider groups in different counties of the state. The rate reduction itself has a bad impact. The rate reduction coupled with client reductions puts providers in a place that, depending on what their individual clients look like, if they both lose income, certainly in these five-bed foster homes, if they lose Medicaid income and they lose clients and they have empty beds that can't be filled, yes, you do lose capacity. Mm-hmm. Residential care facilities, about 80 of them, as I mentioned, have distinct Alzheimer's units within them. And we've got 1,912 Medicaid clients in residential care facilities. About 500 of these folks live in these distinct Alzheimer's care units. The Alzheimer's care rate that's paid is $1,840 a month. There is no proposal to reduce that rate because there's enough problems already finding Medicaid access for folks with severe dementia. So because that rate is factored in here, you'll see that the current average monthly Medicaid rate is slightly higher than the adult foster homes, but we propose to make the same level of decrease to the non-dementia rates as we did in adult foster homes. So that rate would decrease to an average of about $1,212 a month per client, and it would be a 15% decrease. And it would be for those 1,400 folks who are not in the dementia units. They're just in the general residential care facility.
Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
Thank you. I missed the reimbursement for Alzheimer's. For 18 what?
Oh, Senator Winters, Senator Morris, $1,840 a month as a service rate.
Mr. Britton.
Julia, just to clarify a couple of things. These rates are not based on cost analysis like the nursing facility rates are?
No, you're correct, John. They're not based on cost analysis. The department has no legal capability to gather cost data on a regular basis from community-based care facilities.
And the second clarification is, other than nursing facilities, these rates do not include room and board. The nursing facility rates are designed to cover room and board. These are not.
Yes, you're correct. Thank you. And what's anticipated is that the Social Security income payment the client receives goes to the provider as a room and board payment. Page 104 briefly goes through assisted living facilities. There's 187 of them in the state with a capacity of about 12,200 beds. When we counted up on March 31st, there were 3,475 Medicaid clients in assisted living facilities. The current average monthly rate is about $1,567 per client per month. The governor's budget proposes a substantial reduction, 30%, down to $1,097 a month.
Can you give me the rationale behind the 30% reduction?
The 30% reduction, Chair Winters, prior to the proposal, the revised House Bill 5100 proposal that reduces residential care rates and reduces adult foster home rates, a 30% reduction would bring in assisted living facilities the rate paid for comparable care to comparable clients in line with rates that would have been paid to adult foster homes and to residential care facilities.
Let's see if I get this. So the 30% reduction was to try to pair them with the same rate that we're paying for adult foster care.
Senator Winters, for adult foster care and for residential care, the idea was to make payment for clients in facilities in the community comparable and based solely on client need.
So the discussion that we had last session that had to do with the default issue and those issues did not enter into the decision.
Madam Chair, it absolutely did. And in the internal discussions we had, we made that point many times, that we would be back at this situation with the estimated number of programs. That we actually, 3 or 4 months ago already, we met with the Community Housing Agency with Repine and his entire staff and went through pretty carefully to try to estimate what that impact would be. So I think we were very aware of what that impact would be, and this is the same reduction that was brought forward as the budget targets for reductions grew and as we ended up then sparing many of the levels because we couldn't go that deep in our discussions with the federal government. But I don't think we were naive about that at all. We knew exactly what that impact would be.
I guess it's kind of interesting because one of the things that we constantly, in looking at budgets, well, looking at what we do as a state government and our ability to keep commitments or non-commitments when we ourselves have gone out and asked people to do certain things and then we come back and we kind of whack them at the knees. That was the discussion last session, and it's very troublesome that we continue to have these discussions. A 30% reduction when you've asked somebody to make the kind of investment that has been made in communities across this state is huge. I mean, it's very huge. And then we wonder why there is this distrust. It's
ditto.
Ditto. My board members are sitting there saying ditto. I really do want to have an impact statement from Housing and Community Services as to what this really does mean. What do? Do we mothball them? Where do our seniors go should this occur?
Can I make a comment?
Representative Smith.
Throughout this entire day's testimony, we keep going down this road. It's very dangerous, in my opinion. We have an aging population, and we don't seem to be concerned about that. And we have people where the needs are increasing. It seems to be we're taking away the things that matter the most and would pay off the most, and then we end up doing the most expensive thing in the end because we're in a crisis situation. somehow we've got to turn this ship around a little bit. I don't know what we're going to do with that, but we're going to be in a worse situation come 5, 10, 15 years from now if we implement some of these things that we've heard today.
Think about it. If we input some of the things that we're talking about today, and then you go right back out to the community and ask them to, again, come and invest with us, and they're gone, do you get them to reinvest? And I know we have the task of trying to balance this, help balance this budget. This group, this committee selected children and seniors as our number one priority. And, you know, our task is to follow those principles, and we will continue to comb and work as hard as we can to make sure we have it, we take care of the needy. But I do want those questions answered from Housing and Community Services as to what are the impacts. I think we need to know specifically what it means so that we can make some informed decisions. Senator Clark.
Since we are sharing, you know, having a little levity at this moment, if you will.
Am I laughing?
Yeah, just a little perspective here. You know what it feels like as I grow older in the state? It makes you think, should I stay here? Will the future legislature undignify me as much as we are doing here? And it's a scary cause, not you, the department, but all of us as a society, that as we grow older in the state and we're making these decisions, and then 10 years from now we take our turns, and some of us even right now, but who happen to be probably a dollar a month above where this would be with us if we were there too, it really gives you pause for reflection in terms of, is the future legislature going to be the same way with us? And I tell you, it's a scary thing to believe that we're doing our seniors and our kids the way that we're doing them in the state, and I'm not feeling very comfortable about this at all.
Ditto.
Madam Chair, may I step in here for just a brief second?
Yes, Mr. Knott.
Just to remember what James said a moment ago, the reductions that you see here before you, a lot of debate. This was the third round of what this agency tried to do. This was the last place that they went to. And again, when you look at the big picture of what's going on with the state budget, the Representative Westland's committee has dealt with the fact, or is wrestling with the fact, that we have a 40% reduction in state resources going to the Oregon Health Plan. You have the developmental disability system that's locked up in a lawsuit. You have a mental health system that's having its own problems with disarray right now. If you go at the levels of dollars that you're talking about, it ends up coming out of one of those three or four big programs. And this agency, to their defense, is not bringing this forward because they are not aware of the impacts or think this is good public policy. They absolutely do not believe that.
Mr. Nutton, we appreciate your comments. We also appreciate that this body ultimately has all of those other pieces that you talked about. This subcommittee has, I think, the most difficult task in this building, you know, by far. And I kind of wish that I could take all 90 members in this body and have them see a real view of the faces and the individuals that we're talking about as we listen to the testimony before us. It's going to be an extremely difficult task by this body. We deal with every human face that's in society that comes to us. We selected in the beginning that because we knew the budget was bad, that we wanted to make sure that we took care of the most vulnerable, and the most vulnerable to us was children and seniors. I think in terms of as Senator Carter said, I'd like to be remembered of how we treated those that were the least able to take care of themselves. There's something about society if that someone said we're known by how we treat those who can't do for themselves. And certainly children don't have a voice. And certainly I look at other countries and I say, you know, it's kind of interesting that this great country of ours in America, we need to age with dignity. For those who have prepared the way for the rest of us who are younger and who made those sacrifices for us, I think we need to pay them the ultimate compliment. So, and that's not to diminish the task that we have. I think those of us that are here on this committee understand that we have a tremendous budgetary task this session to do. And I, like I said, I wish that all 90 members could sit here and hear what we have to hear. But I'm not willing just to accept that's the way it is. I think that we also have to be diligent and make sure that we have done everything possible to make sure that seniors and kids are being taken care of.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carter.
George and James, and I want you to say this is not a reflection of the department. Yeah. My comments about us as a body and us as a society. This is not a department thing. You have to deal with what we send your way. So certainly you are doing your job and what you're supposed to be doing, and that is bringing us the best information you have available, and we make the decision. So this is not about you guys. My commentary is one about us as a society and seeing the conditions that we are in and looking at the resources we have available to us now without looking at future possibilities of what we can do so we won't have to face these kind of drastic cuts.
Yeah, I would echo. I think that all of us here recognize, I think for the first, that all of us are in this together. I think I started this when I started my hearing. So this is not about the agency or the governor and the legislature or the advocates or the stakeholders. It's about a situation in Oregon where we're all in this. And, you know, I've tried to make sure that, you know, that I'm working with all the groups, that we're all a part of this outcome. Because certainly this is not the time in our history of the state where we're pulling against each other. This is a time in our history where we're all sitting down to work together to get the best that we can out of the crisis that we're in. And certainly the agencies, we were just commenting, Mr. Britton and I, how doing our 101s, and we're very, very grateful of the information that you're bringing forward. And I know that that George and Britton and the governor's office, that everybody's been trying to work together on these issues. But I, as policymakers, not only those who are sitting up here, but those who are not here, also have to understand the gravity and the magnitude of where we are. This may be a good place for us, unless my colleagues have something else to weigh in. Senator Cordley.
Well, I guess I can't be quiet. As I've been listening, I'm just thinking, Madam Chair, respecting everything you've said, and most certainly your words are so eloquent, also respecting your history on these issues and the process. I would just also remind us that it is our constitutional responsibility as legislators to balance the budget, most certainly. But we also have a constitutional responsibility, as is laid out in Article 9, Sections 2 and 6 of the Constitution, which is the chapter on finance, to, when there are insufficient funds to operate government services, it says that the legislature shall levy a tax. And as we look at the magnitude of these cuts and the human impacts, we cannot escape that obligation and that responsibility, which is also our opportunity in the days ahead to start talking about increasing revenue.
Any other comments? Thank you. And I think we're adjourned until Monday. Just a second. I need to have, on Monday, we have some applications, federal grant application requests. I need a quorum. So,
yes, ma'am.
So try to be here on time so that I can get these application requests done. It could bring us in some more revenue, which we so desperately need.
Tell these caucus leaders to let us out.
I will send a note to your caucus leaders to make sure they let you out so that you can get here to take care of subcommittee business. Senator Morris, do you have anything else?
I do, but not today.
Okay. You are adjourned until Monday.